Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner right here on your Mark Steiner Show, on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We have with us this hour Dr. Sonia Santelices, who, of course, is the new CEO. Well, not so new, it's been months now. CEO of our Baltimore City School System, joins us in studio. Dr. Santelices, welcome. Good to have you with us in the house.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
And y'all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. But do join us. I mean, I'd love to hear from parents. I would say students and teachers, but y'all probably in school and working. But if you're having a break or something, 410-319-8888. Or send me an email, and there we'll see us from somebody else. No, just kidding. 410-319-8888. Do join us. There's a lot to talk about. And we do look forward to you coming into this conversation. There's so many places to begin. You gave what I actually saw for the first time early this morning, was that very impassioned state of the school address, I suppose.
Sure,
right?
Sure, yeah.
Which I thought was very powerful. The question, you know, when I was thinking about what you said, that we had, when you have a city, and 80,000 some, how many students do we have now?
81,000.
Mm-hmm. And 81,000 students in our schools, the majority of whom, just by statistics, come from poor working class homes. Mm-hmm. Many come from neighborhoods that cause a lot of trauma and stress with these children. And I know you are someone who said before in your past that, or not in your past, but have said that you are, and it's a joke you were saying this about yourself, that you're an elitist because you believe every child can do something in school, and look to your father who grew up in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And became a chemist, mm-hmm. despite segregation and Jim Crow and mm-hmm. the terror of the South. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about a population of young people who live, I think, in some of the worst conditions that America has had to offer in a couple hundred years, mm-hmm. right? Or 100 years, whatever now that number is, for a long time. So when you say that, so this, is there a contradiction in that? And what does that mean? I mean, we have a school system now that seems we're so hell-bent on testing that the rest of education is left out. So, I mean, how do you?
Yeah, I mean, it's
unscramble that.
And unscrambling is a great way to describe the work that has to be done. But I think fundamentally, you know, for me, on that kind of elitist edge, or what people have deemed to be elitist edge, is I think every young person in our schools needs to be given the kind of education, the kind of messaging that communicates that they are human beings who are capable of complex thought. And one of the things I found interesting when I was digging through, I was reading with my girls a new book, I'll have to get you the title of it, but on young people in the civil rights movement, and this one was a picture book. And one of the things when they were, there was one chapter on what white students in the segregated South were being told about black people during the whole desegregation piece, particularly in Alabama. And one of the quotes that I literally took a picture of from the book is a young white student at the time who is recounting how she was told by teachers, by school leaders, that actually black people are not intellectually capable of complex thought. They can only learn by rote memory. They can only do very static one-step activities. And that is what was being propagated, like very, very directly. And so for me, while it might look different, and I am by no means saying that every young person that goes through our system should be taking AP Calculus BC, right? And that's what validates them as complex thought. I think that we have too often reduced the kind of education and the goals for that education to just the most simplistic, as I call, kind of baby food learning, where we chop things up so finely that it signals to kids that we actually don't see them as capable of that. And I was talking with some young people last night. I was fortunate that that the YALA group, the young, I think it's the Academy, the Youth Ambassador Leadership Academy.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So I was talking to some of the YALA young people last night, and what's interesting, many of them have come through AOP programs. You know, these are kids who are facing some of the most challenging conditions that, as you noted, we've seen in probably 100 years or at least many, many decades at the least. And one of the themes among many that was striking to me is they know what people think of their capability. And they talk about, I mean, the number of times I heard young people say, they must think I'm stupid. They must think I'm stupid. Signals to me that this is not just some pipe dream. This is not just something I'm imagining because I happen to have a dad who was a chemist and a mom who was a social worker, right? I'm not just imagining this. The young people today in our classrooms, in our city, are getting that message from somewhere. And they were talking about their experiences in our schools. So I think that's part one. The other part is, you know, to your point about the testing culture. And, you know, look, I worked in D.C. for 3 years, you know, fighting, and people can agree or disagree that we still need to have a standard, because I don't think in the history of our country we have a good track record of taking away a standard and holding all young people, regardless of background, to a standard. So I think that that is important. But I have also said it's short-sighted if we don't acknowledge in very real ways that these are whole kids that we're teaching. And to ignore those conditions, to ignore their challenges, to ignore what many of them have to go through just to make it to class, just to make it to the school, doesn't serve us well. And I think that is on those of us who lead systems and agencies within the city and the community to better integrate our work, because kids aren't compartmentalized. They experience it all, right? So they experience their interactions with the criminal justice system at the same time that whether their health needs are met, at the same time that they meet a teacher who is or is not prepared. They don't compartmentalize it. For them, it's their daily experience. And the piece that institutions have not done a good job with is better integrating, starting with the young people and moving backwards. We start with our systems and our departments and our specialization, and then we try to push in on kids and communities instead of starting with their experiences and asking ourselves how we rearrange how we do the work to better suit their needs, to meet them where they are. And that's part of what we're bumping up against.
So, and folks, we're going to get to these phones here, 410-319-8888. Melissa, you're the first caller up. Let me ask this question. We'll get to your call. We have a very extensive email that I got last night that I want to read from a parent. But please join us here at 410-319-8888. So the question I have, I mean, there are a lot of people who say we have too much testing in our schools. We're over-testing our children. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if you look at the numbers of tests our kids take, it is overwhelming.
Absolutely.
And how should that be cut back, and how do you cut that back? I mean, you went, and this is, I'm not saying this to cast an aspersion, but you, because it's not an aspersion at all. You went to a private school growing up, part of your education.
For high school, yes.
High school, right?
Yep.
As did one of my daughters. You know, they don't test children the way we test children in public schools. Hmm. I mean, they have their tests, they have their projects, and teachers are expected to grade them on their success. And then the kids might take a test at the end of the year, testing reading and math or what other mm-hmm. skills or history skills they may have picked up. And at the end, they'll take an SAT if they're going to go to college, and you can see what they've learned by taking the SAT. So, but we have this thing where we are telling teachers, and you may even believe in this, that they should be evaluated on the test scores that their children that they're teaching get. I mean, and then we have these schools where this testing is taking place, but there's no music, there's no art, there's no creative aspects of the school at all.
Yeah.
And to me, education is a three-legged school. It's academics, art, and athletics. You know, to me, not one is more important than the other.
Agreed.
If you want to give kids who think, or whole children, and think with any kind of complexity.
No, and we have gone overboard, and I have said that. But what I also believe is that in a number of cases, we are focusing on the wrong target, right? An end of the year summative achievement-based test is, to me, is not our major issue. Our major issue is at the district level. And again, having studied this across the country, not just in Baltimore, most of the test increase has come from an increase in state testing, state-required tests, and local-required tests. So part of what I have done since I've been here, and in fairness, some of the examination began in the administration before me, is saying, are we giving too many tests? I've been on the ground asking teachers, right? We have an iReady assessment. And I've been asking teachers, is it giving you information that is even necessary, right? And, you know, I do know that there are, you know, to your earlier point, there are private schools who give progress monitoring. It's just not a high-stress situation.
Right.
And it's not all the time. And you're absolutely right. It should not replace art and music. And it should not replace those other experiences. You're saying art and music. It shouldn't replace science in the elementary school, right?
Right.
It shouldn't replace
history.
History, right?
Social studies.
It shouldn't replace any of that. And we do have an issue. But I think it goes back to what I started with. It's a minimalist idea of what it means when we say we want all kids to standard. And I don't think that that means we don't give variation. On the point about teacher evaluation, I've been a big advocate of really looking at how are we assessing a teacher's impact on the growth of students, right? And some measures are imperfect for that. When you have kids that are, I went to a school last week. I went to Booker T. Washington Middle, I don't think they'll mind me saying, where you can look, and 0% of the kids were in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade were scoring proficient or advanced on the PARC. And I went there, had a conversation with some teachers and teacher leads there, and the measure that they need to be able to do their work is not, to be honest, fully PARC, right? They've got to take it back. And when you look at other measures, there are people there that are moving kids because they were getting kids who were reading at a second grade level in sixth grade. That does not mean they're at standard, but it does mean that a teacher should be recognized for contributing growth to young people. So I've always been an advocate of what is the growth that we're seeing on the way to the target. And I've said before, you know, yeah, teachers should be able to teach my children. They had 100 books in their library in utero. So actually, you better be able to teach them to read. That's on you if you can't.
Right,
right? And so, but that kind of, you know, growth focus, I think, impacts all kids, right? So whether you're coming in way behind or you're coming in ahead, right? Because we also have young people who are ready for more. And because they're at proficient, people think, oh, the job is done. And I'm like, well, they came to you proficient, or they came to you advanced and they slipped to proficient. What does that say about growth? So I think that needs to be the goal.
So let me open the phones here and I'll come back to the questions, and then I'll read this email at the break. 410-319-8888. We're talking with Dr. Sonia Santelices, the CEO of Baltimore City Schools. You can email us at talkatsteinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner. I haven't seen a tweet yet, but I know they'll be coming in. 410-319-8888. I'm still waiting for my first Trump tweet. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Dr. Santelices.
Good morning.
I was privileged enough last year to be a guest, actually, with you, Mark Steiner, and some guests from OSI, the Office of Public Defender, regarding school discipline and school policing.
Oh, yes, right, mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm the parent of a third grader, and advocates, a coalition of advocates now has been waiting nearly 2 years for you to publish any policies at all regarding the training of school police officers, discipline and oversight for those officers. And your predecessor, the former CEO, had promised repeatedly that data would be available on arrest rates, including for students with disabilities, once Infinite Campus, the new data system, came online this year. And we're still waiting. And I have to say, I'm really offended by this, because tonight, the school board is taking up a procurement for new uniforms for officers. So to me as a parent, it feels incredibly disrespectful that you can take up a procurement to spend more money. And I'll note that it's about $7 million for school policing right now in a city that is burdened by many, many challenges and talks about community schools and money needed there. about $7 million for school police, and a procurement tonight for new uniforms when we still don't have policies, even after the NAACP recommended that we have them following the DOJ investigation. So I want to know from you right now, what is the holdup with getting those policies in place? We're not in compliance with a secure rule from DOJ and from the Department of Ed, and we haven't been for years. Parents and advocates are asking for a voice, and we are continually denied one.
Well, thank you, Michelle, and let me...
Melissa.
Melissa, sorry. Thank you, Melissa, for the questions and the reflection and frankly, the charge. Let me just update you that actually since I have arrived in July, we have had meetings with advocates. We actually previewed the new data system with a group of advocates who have been working collaboratively with the system, and sometimes painfully, and sometimes, you know, not agreeing, but got initially very good feedback a couple of weeks back when we previewed our new iCampus data system. We got feedback from advocates around the kind of data we were collecting on student arrests that we will now be able to publish. They reviewed that, and actually we got very good feedback and even had members of the Public Defender's Office there. So we have moved forward on that. I will say in terms of the discipline policy, we are going to third reader soon, which is coming to the end of when policy will be put in place around student discipline. And we have again received a good amount of feedback. That doesn't mean we've agreed on everything, but we have tried. I have responded to a number of advocates' concerns that when they got feedback, they weren't sure where the feedback went. We've rectified that in terms of making sure that we have open channels of communication. We have had those meetings. As a matter of fact, our Office of School Discipline had a meeting, I think sometime within the last 2 weeks, again, with a group of advocates, who are working specifically on school discipline, on school policing. We have moved forward with that. We still, for example, are going to have to do a rewrite of police orders. But what we have tried to do in the interim is propose, work with, again, some of the advocates' recommendations. And again, we don't agree on everything, but we do have drafts of that. We have been in communication. And what we have said is that we're going to phase in, starting with kind of the general policies of school policing. We've been working on that in the fall with the goal of having those in place in January. So I did want to just provide that update to you, because we actually have been working in the last few months since I've been in office, since July, to really move forward in the areas that you, and not that we certainly do not have a long way to go, but I have, since I have been very open to meeting with advocates, and we have actually released data and information. They were asked for a copy, a number of advocates asked for a copy of the MOU that we have with Baltimore City Police, I'm assuming primarily because even before the DOJ report came out, there were advocates who requested that, and they had not received it. Immediately when I was made aware that request had not been addressed, we have since released that MOU almost immediately. So not that we don't have a long way to go, but there are a lot of what you have stated, I think we have been addressing.
So very quickly, though, in the heart of Melissa's question, Baltimore City is the only jurisdiction in the state that has its own police force for city schools. Mm-hmm. Some argue we don't need the police force in the city schools. That we have, you could have some other ways of people ensuring safety of students without the police, that money could be better used somewhere else, or they could be folded back into the police department, whatever else. Yep. A and B, added to that, that we should just end suspensions and come up with policies that put our arms around the students who are causing trouble and are in trouble to make sure they remain in school and not having them arrested unless they've committed some grievous assault or something on a teacher or another student or a sexual assault or whatever. But beyond that, we should be treating them very differently than we do. Do we really need city police schools? Do we need a city police force in our schools?
So I think where we are now in terms of where we sit now as a school system, where we sit now as a city, I have approached that question, probably not with the direct answer you want me to say, yes or no, because I don't think it's a yes or no. I think for now what we have said is we need a different kind of school policing, right? And we need school policing that is much more about relationship building. We have examples of school police officers, individuals, who have amazing relationships with young people in the community, who do an excellent job at diffusing conflict, who are part of their school communities. And we have others who, frankly, are not as strong and might be in the wrong place. And so we are working to make sure that those expectations are clear. We have ramped up significantly the training that school police undergo. We found out that many school police officers, frankly, do not know adolescent development. So some of the things that they're seeing as particular behavior is a natural outgrowth of the developmental curve of what a 15-year-old does. And so not every, you know, side crack response warrants that kind of action. So I think for now what we have taken in place and kind of listening to school leaders, listening to community and parents, where we do have agreement is that the kind of policing we had is not sufficient. And so part of where we have been moving is being clearer, again, and this is in large part to advocates, being very clear about what the role of school police in buildings are and doing a deeper dive on suspensions so that we're getting at the suspensions that are not for serious altercation, that the suspensions that, frankly, are up for great interpretation, things like, you know, disrespectful interaction. Like, what is that? Like, depending on who the adult is, one adult's disrespect is another adult just a teenager who needs to be left alone and kind of in a chill out de-escalation mode. We are training our police officers in de-escalation. And so for right, while long term, we'll continue to grapple with that question of you know, where school police fits. I think now and in the immediate, what we do have agreement on is that we need the shift, and we have plans in place for the shift. And our responsibility, and Acting Chief Hamm and I have had these discussions, is we have to be able to scrutinize our own behavior and our own policies, but also help those school police who are successful in actually spreading their best practice. Yeah.
So we have to take a short break here. We're going to come right back. Jill, you're the first caller up. When we come back from break, I'm going to come back and read this email from a parent. And then we're going to talk at SteinerShow.org. And we're going to call Jill. And then we're going to take some other, we're going to be talking about hopefully charter schools and our city schools and more during the course of the next half an hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show, and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And on our way back to our conversation with Dr. Sonia Santelices, I want to remind you The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. They're celebrating their 80th anniversary at www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. Jill and Allie, we're going to come to your calls. I want to read this email and get to your calls. And I do want to raise these issues about charter schools and lead paint before we end our conversation today. I'll try to read most of this. This is fairly long, and might have to shorten a bit of it, but let me read this to you from a parent. Our daughter was six and in kindergarten, and this is anonymous. She wants to remain anonymous, doesn't want to name the school or her daughter's name, but I will give this information to Dr. Santelices when she leaves and you can respond personally. Okay. Our daughter was six and in kindergarten and having a lot of problems. She was referred for extensive testing by a neuropsychologist at Mount Washington Pediatric. They diagnosed her with ADHD, dyslexia, slow processing speed, and sensory processing disorder. She was in a private school, but we were planning to send her to a public school the following year and wanted to get the process started to get her services and support. We went to our zone school to discuss getting her an IEP. We had two meetings with the IEP team. During the first, they seemed to not believe what I told them. I told them about my daughter's disabilities, though I gave them the entire neuropsychological report. So for the second meeting, they after they had done an observation of our daughter at school, the doctor agreed to attend by phone. When she explained that our daughter was about 3 years behind in reading and writing skills, they said that many of the children at their school were that far behind. So that wasn't exceptional. Mm-hmm. They also said that they had a different definition of dyslexia than the doctor did, and that included our daughter failing an entire year of school with their curriculum. Mm-hmm. They ended up denying us any services for her learning disabilities, an IEP, no tutoring, occupational therapy, etc., and suggested that the only problem was psychiatric, and they would offer counseling services, but nothing else. When I spoke to the doctor, later she said she had never experienced such pushback from a special ed team about a diagnosis, and that our daughter definitely needed special immediate interventions for her learning challenges. I spoke to an advocate later who said that they did not do correct testing or follow procedures for an IEP review, and that I could appeal and go directly through the whole process, but we felt discouraged, and there was hostility towards us from the team already. It was not time before the enrollment, and that so we did not send her to public school. I forgot, and at first, in addition, the possibility of counseling, they could suggest a self-contained class, a school for children with psychiatric problems, and that we were told by a number of people, including one person who works with North Avenue, that there were only a few schools in the city, Roland Park, Mount Washington, Federal Hill, that were able to provide decent interventions for the kind of learning disabilities that our daughter has, and we'd be much better off moving to the county that indeed has those services.
Oh, that's depressing.
Mm-hmm. It was when she told me about this
so
personally.
Depressing. Well, and it's depressing on a number of counts. Number one, just parents should not have to endure, and I actually will follow up if, you know, when you give me the information. Parents should not have to endure that kind of dismissal of concern about their young people, particularly in a case like this where there is documentation, but even when there's not. And some of that is part of how we need to change the posture of how we are serving our families, particularly from central office. And I also think that the kind of flippant, you know, and again, I don't know, I'll have to look into this case in particular, so I don't want to just, you know, throw our special ed team under the bus either, but I will say this, the flippant dismissal about how far behind a young person is should never be reason for not addressing a student's disability. I mean, the fact that those were even put together in kind of the same response to a parent is not only troubling, but it's what I call professional malpractice. And it is, I think, part of the challenge we have, and it gets back to your unscrambling analogy, that we, you know, part of why I need kids to be capable of complex thought and be trained and educated for complex thought is because I need adults in the system, right, who are capable of complex thought, because this is a complex case, right? This is not a straight check a box, right? You're 3 years behind, so, you know, A, you go down path B.
But the fact they said to her that this is not so exceptional, a lot of our kids are 3 years
behind.
I mean,
that's highly
pretty stunning to me.
Oh, and it is. Well, you saw my face,
yes,
like in the studio as you were reading it, and I was just aghast. And it's, you know, those are the kinds of things where I will take back. It's a great case, and it's also why our families and our parents need voice. And what is so sad to me is that this parent, like word on the street, at least for this parent, is that there's only three schools in the system that can address her child's needs, and that is not true.
Because and they would be the schools that Dr. Lawrence Brown calls in the white L, not the black butterfly.
Wow. That's a great, I'm going to have to quote on that one. But we have other schools who actually do a good job with this type of learner. And it gets down to what I often reference is the real challenge of urban education is scale, right? It is, we have pockets of excellence. There are teachers in schools, not in the white L, right? But in the black W, who could do right by this student. The challenge is, who's the person answering the phone? Right? Who's the first interaction of this family? How are we not only training our folks centrally for exactly complex diagnosis, right? And I said, I got hot with some administrators 2 weeks ago, and I said, you know, I'm tired of everybody telling me the kids aren't capable of complex thoughts when I need adults who are capable of complex thoughts.
And I think that we don't have time to go into this today, but one of my critiques of public education has been, period, these days, is that we don't when I interview high school kids in Baltimore City, who I know are bright kids, I can feel it, I can see it in our conversations.
Yes.
They can't use the English language to describe complexity of thought.
Yes.
Which is a crime to
our
children.
Well, that's because people don't want, and this goes back to what I originally said, though, Mark, is when you only think of some kids as being capable of a certain type of education, that is what you get, right? That is what you get. And that is the problem. And it's also the problem of we're so into standardization that, again, you have kids that don't fit neatly into boxes, and it's a challenge of large bureaucracy, but it never excuses interfacing with families in the way that this person described.
So our original caller, Melissa, has tweeted in, but let me go to two new callers, and I'll read her tweet after these callers. 410-319-8888. Jill in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark. Dr. Santa Lisa, hello. Joe, I'm a member of the Baltimore Arts Education Coalition. I was the fine arts specialist in Baltimore for 9 years. Could you talk about the equity in opportunity for particularly discipline-based arts education where kids actually learn to play instruments, learn the visual arts, theater, dance? I know we've made some progress adding some teachers in the last 2 years, but, you know, it's an equity issue. You cross the county line in every direction, and every kid has it. I know we've made some progress in arts integration, but I'm particularly concerned about the discipline base.
No, and
good
you
question.
Are.
Thank you, Jill.
Yes, it is a good question, and you know you're not alone in that concern. I share it. I think the reality is we have had to prioritize and identify the starting points, and one of the, you know, I don't want to say great surprises, but it was definitely welcome when I arrived was to see that the district had actually made progress in increasing access to arts education. You are correct in that arts integration is not, you know, progressing in the actual art discipline. I think one of the things that we are doing and one of the approaches that I am taking is kind of a regional view of the city and schools so that we actually can map out where those experiences are. We can begin to say, are there whole zip codes or regions where young people do not have access to learning a progression of study of, say, an instrument, just as example. And we are looking at that. We're going to look at that more deeply in the coming years because we really need to dive deeply in middle grades. That's where we're losing a lot of that continuum, particularly in the arts and in the early grades. So I completely agree with you. We're working with partners. And some of it is resourcing. Some of it is resourcing. And in a city where we have to spend, frankly, $8,000 for a broken glass window, that needs on a school that needs to be replaced 5 times in an 18-month period, and we do replace it because we don't believe kids should be sitting with broken glass, there is a greater need, an even greater need to prioritize resources. So we are looking at it, we're paying attention to it, and the question's going to be how fast we can get there. But I do think with this kind of regional mapping of resources, what we're trying to do is say, are we covering kind of essential zip codes within the city and making sure that large gaps we're addressing first? But it is going to take us some time to get there. But the commitment is there, and we are talking with partners about how to make sure we continue to grow in that area. But you're absolutely right.
I won't follow up. Let me just go to the phones, I promise. 410-319-8888. Allie in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Taking my call.
Sure.
I have a specific question about the way that charters get their students. So it's supposed to be through a lottery, and that lottery is supposed to be fair so that their students should look like the city because it should be due to chance. But they get many, many waivers, one of which that can be abused and is abused widely, is that staff and teacher kids get in. So they can, off their granted side of the charter, not off the public side, but off the nonprofit side, they can hire staff that, you know, from the kids that they want. And I just want to know, are you guys checking that?
So it is a good question, and I will say this, that not all charters fit the same demographic profile, right? So we have, for example, conversion charters who pretty much still take young people from the neighborhood in which they're situated. We have other charters who, as you are right, do have a lottery system. There's nothing inherent in the lottery system that should so dramatically swing a student population towards one side or the other merely because staff are there. I would argue staff's children, excuse me, are there. It doesn't mean that we can't take a look at it. I do think that in the case of smaller schools, some of that disproportionality might appear, you know, far more accentuated or far more serious than in others. And we have a varying scale of poverty within our charter schools and frankly even in some of our neighborhood schools. Some of that within charters is word gets around. And so the folks who apply tend to be, you know, it can catch very quickly, and then it becomes a who has enough either stability, wherewithal, access, even though theoretically on paper, everyone can apply. I had the opportunity to talk to a number of recent students who came from immigrant families at CASA, and one of the things that they were saying, they had a very interesting take on school choice. And their take was school choice was incredibly limited for them because their parents, their families were not in a position to access the lotteries. They didn't get the information in time. They were behind. The lotteries had already been held. And so it really did cause me to go back and really think about what do we need to change in the kind of public communication around our schooling options so that every family has access. But yeah, more than willing to take a look at that, but we do have a wide range.
So quick follow-up here, we've got about 15 minutes left. Randy, mm-hmm. I'm going to come to your call. I want to read this tweet coming in. But the follow-up on the charter schools very quickly. There's a lawsuit.
Yep.
The charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who's, since I was a school teacher, although it was many years ago, and organized for the union and was all for ideas of charter schools and teacher-controlled schools, which I believed in then, I still believe in today. Mm-hmm. But having said that, there's something amiss here. I mean, A, the lawsuit to me is troubling mm-hmm. for lots of reasons. But B, there's an inequity in our charter schools. If you're a charter school, and I'm going to say this with all due respect, if you're a charter school started by somebody who's wealthy and white, you get resources like city bonds and other things to do what you want to rebuild a school and get money. If you're a charter school started by black parents or black educators trying to do something different and don't have access to that money, then your school doesn't get any more money than anybody else's school does, for the most part, even though you're trying to do something different. Something's wrong with the way we do it. Something was right the way we did charters by keeping private corporations out, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Something's wrong with how it's developed in this kind of inequity inside of our charter school system and its relationship to our traditional schools. Witness what's happening with Montessori, the argument there with his own school there that could lose everything if they in that process. So, I mean, so where are you with all this?
So I think where we are. Thanks, Mark, for such a simple, quick question. But I think part of where we are is one. You know, that I have been having conversations with representatives of the charter schools. I think one, we need to open up communication. And communication, when I entered, had really soured. And you can't solve anything unless you're willing to talk with folks.
True.
Number two, some of our schools that are having great success with our young people are charter schools. Some of our traditional schools are as well. We have a mixed profile of schools that are doing
right.
incredibly well by our kids and those who are struggling and perhaps
should not
continue.
Go to school 64 in Liberty Heights.
Exactly, right? So we have both. But right now in Baltimore, what I've said is we have need of a greater critical mass of schools that are doing right by our young people. And I don't think kind of getting rid of charters is the answer
no.
to that at all.
No. Nope.
Where I do think we have concerns and issues is transparency around funding. I think charters, at least representatives I've talked to, don't feel as if they have a truly transparent understanding of funding. And to the credit of a number of parents and community members in traditional schools, they are actually asking questions now as well. And they are saying the same thing. We want to know how charters are funded as opposed to traditional schools. And then I think your point within the charter community, one of the things that in the design of charters, and you raise a great, equity question. You're right. We have charter schools that leverage incredible outside money. And it does pale in comparison to other charters' ability to leverage incredible amounts of outside money. And what does that mean in terms of who is starting charters, the performance of those charters? I will tell you, in our review of charter applications, that does not come to bear. And I reviewed charter applications when I was chief academic officer, and I was looking for the quality of the plan. And we approved charters that were being proposed by local community groups, by, in some cases, advocates or parents and teachers, based on the quality of the plan. And we have rejected some outside, supposedly well-funded applications from those who weren't. Do we need to look at the equity implications? Absolutely.
So a long conversation we have to have of these
things. Yes, if you want to come back and just do charters, we'll have to
do that. We can do that. We can do a series of that. As you have time, it'd be important.
Yeah.
And let me also make a full disclosure. I'm saying this as I've been asked to be on the board of the Banneker Blake Charter
mm-hmm.
School. So
mm-hmm.
let me put that out there to be fully transparent, as we say. 410-319-8888.
Sure.
Randy, you're on the air. Welcome. Good morning, Randy.
Earlier, there was a parent who was a little fearful about identifying herself, and she had a child in special ed.
Right.
Was supposed to receive services, but she didn't receive those services, and she was very cagey. And people who understand how special needs kids are sometimes treated, they understand exactly what she's saying, because there is retaliation. And I just wanted to say that there are some excellent programs. Northern Virginia has outside of D.C., Old Town Alexandria, go into those special educational classrooms, and you'll see the exemplary model of how to do it. But when you have poor kids who can't read or dyslexic, oh, no, they're mental. They have this issue. You know, they find the cheap way to do it. And we all suffer because we see these kids roving the street, throwing rocks, acting wild, and when you go to a community meeting, not an educator in sight, only police. And there's a big problem that needs to be addressed, and we can't be afraid. The parent called, that's the first step. But we really have to hold people accountable who are at the helm, and don't allow them to do a lot of double talk. All right, thank you.
Thank you so much, Randy.
I would just agree and say that, you know, parents should. I respect, and again, I will follow up with that with the parent who emailed, even though publicly the parent didn't want to be.
So one of the things that I've been wondering, I've asked this question, I think, of almost every CEO in over the last 23 or 4 years on the air, that lead paint poisoning is a very real issue in Baltimore City. As a matter of fact, one day I ran into Dr. Nancy Grasmick, former state superintendent,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and she was talking about the work she's trying to do at Towson and designing certain kinds of curriculum. And I said, "Why isn't Kennedy Krieger?" And I said, "Why isn't anybody studying the cognitive and behavioral effects of lead paint on our city school children, and not just to study the kids, but come up with a strategy, a pedagogical strategy, mm-hmm. to help them go to the extent they can, maybe it's further than we even think, in terms of their cognitive abilities, who have been poisoned and affected by lead. Maybe we wouldn't have had a Freddie Gray.
Yeah.
If we had had a system that wraps our arms around these children who we know who have been should be tested and we and then can be helped. But there is no curriculum. There is no kind of strategy to work with these kids.
Yeah.
So what do you do to change that?
No, ouch, and mea culpa, right? Like we have not systematically, and I think in as pointed a way that you are describing, gone after this issue. We just haven't. I do think we have opportunities now with a greater level of partnership with the Baltimore City Health Department, and Dr. Lena Wen and her team, and I've continued to say this, have been one of the best welcome back presents I could have received coming back as CEO.
She's very sharp.
She is. And I think we have to partner, and we are realizing that, frankly, as a school system, we don't have the expertise in-house to develop all of these systems, but your push is the right one, given the population. It would be interesting in working with the health department on this to actually get a gauge of where we are as a city with that. And also, again, back to this place-based approach to the work in the city that we're having, how do we target? Because one of the issues we have in a large system is we have some initiatives that go across the city, but we really need to do more kind of customization based on prioritized areas. So I'll just say on that, you're right. And I think where we are partnering around the health piece, you know, we have some opportunity for traction, but we haven't done nearly the work we need to in what you're talking about, which is the actual specific design of interventions geared towards young people who've been affected by lead poisoning. And you're right. And Freddie Gray is an unfortunate portrait of our inability to wrap our hands around the kids and the issue from an educational pedagogical perspective.
I mean, because at the very least, the people are saying that there in the last 10 years, at minimum, there are 5,000 children in the city who've been affected by lead.
Easily.
And those children are in our schools.
Yes. But what it requires, though, Mark, when it gets back to something I said earlier, is we have to redesign our system so that the information is not compartmentalized. And it goes back to seeing young people as whole kids and whole people. They're not compartmentalized. Your lead exposure record should not be separate from your early kindergarten reading readiness assessment. Right? They need to be pieced together to provide a portrait, not to, you know, as one of the previous callers said, to just say, oh, these kids are damaged goods and kind of move them along, but to actually say, so what does the intervention need to be? We have schools now where we have great examples of healthcare being lodged at the school, housed at the school, which reduces not only attendance, right, but increases kids' class time. And what would it look like if we actually could pinpoint who those 5,000 children are, where they are in our system, and be able to structure the resources from that point on? But again, bureaucracies traditionally and even now start with our own stuff instead of starting with the kids and moving backward. And I'm hoping that as we move into more of kind of place-based planning, that we'll be able to do more of that.
Let me get a couple of quick tweets here.
Please.
Juana de la Cruz just tweeted in, is there a reason the radio signal on 88.9 went out as you talked about charters? I had to go online to hear your comments. No, because they're having some issues today.
Oh.
It's gone in and out. I apologize to anybody who's back and with the signals here, but that has happened a little bit today, so I apologize for that, and also to our guests, because this is an important conversation. And Melissa Schwarber tweets back in, she was the first caller today, and says, yes, training ramped up, but policies are missing. Everything is ad hoc. Not okay for this level. Not funding.
And all I would say is that, as I said in my earlier comments, we do have proposed policy on the books that has been reviewed by our advocates, that we are working collaboratively as best we can, knowing that we'll disagree on some things. We actually and the caller can go on our board website. We have an actual proposed policy that is up for board review and vote. And we have worked, we're on third reader. We have received feedback from a number of advocates and partners about that policy. So we actually do have policy in place.
We only have like a few minutes left here, but yep. But you mentioned in your last answer about health and in certain schools. There's organizations in the City Act and others who really are pushing the idea of community schools as mm-hmm, the mm-hmm. way we should go.
Yes.
Where everything is inside that school.
Yep.
Health clinics.
Yes.
More access to the community to use it after the school's closed, for the gym, for classrooms, and more.
Absolutely.
So what about what's your pragmatic approach to that?
So the pragmatic approach, which might sound like a broken record right now, one is, again, we have to be, and you'll notice this in again, the state of schools that I started with. There's a reason why I started with a map of the city. There's a reason why,
right.
You know, I put up data points about, you know, infant mortality. There's a reason why
I put arrests,
right? Homicides, right?
That
there's a reason why, and it gets to this point of we have to see young people as extensions of their communities, and we have to, we do not have, I mean, and this is one of the, I think, indictments of the kind of no excuses, no child left behind era that I do think is an indictment on those of us who were part of that, is we somehow fought that just kind of separating kids and just focusing on the school alone, that all of that stuff would magically go away. And with the number of uprisings, with the number of young people, right, who, even though we haven't done our job correctly in teaching them subject-verb agreement and how to write, right, mm-hmm. and command that, that they are saying in some of these actions, you can't move us as far as you say, even for those of you who say you want to move us, if you don't take into account and respect our parents, our community. I said to a group of parents last week at a parent training, I said, one of the big fallacies that I can admit as an educator is too many of us are not viewing the community and the families as experts in their kids. As people who bring something to the table, they're not something we need to correct for. They're people we need to be partnering with. And so the community schools work is part of that. And it's also why I keep pushing with principals. It'll be part of the work we do. It has to be place-based. It can no longer be the way I entered as a CAO, which was going to schools first. There was a deliberate reason why I have been visiting neighborhoods regularly, because we cannot do this work in this city, or I would argue any other urban city, without doing that.
I appreciate you taking the time to stay this whole hour.
No, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Dr. Sonia Santelisa, CEO of Baltimore City Schools. We will have her back as soon as we can and as often as we can. Conversations about education, which I think is one of the most important conversations we can have about our community and our future. Good to see you. Thank you so much.
Great to see you too. Thanks again.
We're taking a short break, and when we come back, we're talking about the Obama effect. Stay with us.